Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis. Today with us, we have the gift of having Anuj Gamiri. Anuj is an ecologist who recently completed his PhD in zoology with a focus on house sparrows. He comes to us from Fargo, North Dakota by way of Nepal, and we're excited to talk about both places. Welcome, Anuj.
Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm very happy and excited to be here.
Congrats on finishing the PhD. How exhausted are you?
A lot. But I think I'm kind of getting back to my zone again because it's been a while. And I, for some reason, it does not feel like a lot different than when I was doing it. But it just feels like a relief, though.
It just... From what I've heard, I do not have a PhD. Mm-hmm. My husband has a PhD, lots of friends. It's like the monkey on your back that finally you're able to remove.
Yes. So one of the things was like before you're done with it, you're like, oh, I can't wait to be done with it. And you're not, when you're done, you're just done. And like there's nothing that changes. It's just like you're done with a thing. But it's also a big relief, so which is really good.
But then you have to figure out what to do with your free time. But luckily you're a birder, so that takes care of itself, huh?
Exactly, yeah. That's one of my stress relieving thing too. So every time I'm stressed or like feeling low, I go birding. And every time I'm happy, I go birding. So there's like birding for all the time. So
should put that on a t-shirt.
Yes, that would be a cool t-shirt.
So your PhD was a focus on house sparrows. Why house sparrows?
It wasn't like that I did want to go in and I want to study house sparrows. So it could have been on anything. I'm more interested in life history trade-off and it could have been on anything. But at this point, I'm really glad that it was on house sparrows because like I got to understand a species that people don't usually care about a lot. And I got to learn a lot about them and they're really special to me now because I worked for 6 years on them. But it wasn't like I wanted to study house sparrows. I would have studied owls, I guess. But the research that I wanted to do was being done in house sparrows in my advisors, like my previous advisor's lab, which is a great place to work on too. And I got a lot of experience and things. So like it was more research-based than species-based for that one.
Got it.
Yeah. Yep.
What can you teach us about house sparrows? I know they're everywhere, right? Aren't they on almost every country on Earth?
Yep. Every country, every continent, they're everywhere. Mm. But so they're in their original places, like in the UK and in the Asia where they originally come from, the population seems to be declining. But here in the US, they seem to be stable or like even going up, I think. But yeah, so like here, they're thought of as being a pest. People usually don't like them. But back home, people usually are like, oh, we need to save house sparrows and stuff. So I was back home after 4 years last winter. And whenever I went to people, they were like, oh, you study house sparrows. And I used to see a bunch of them when I was young. But nowadays, we don't see them. And yeah, things like that. So they're kind of like declining back home. And even in the UK, I've read that they're declining a lot. But they're a neat species. Yeah.
They are. There's something beautiful about a bird that you'll see on a cafe table in New York City and in the mountains in Nepal and in London. And, you know, they can be pesty, but there's also something kind of magical about the fact
McDonald's or any pizza joints where they're stealing pizzas, which is awesome to watch.
Yeah, they have no shame. They're kind of the pigeon version of sparrow, I think.
Yes. Or seagulls of the land.
Right, totally. That's totally. And you studied specifically the difference in their body sizes and what affects that. Tell us a little bit about that size differentiation.
So what I actually, so that was something that I was interested in primarily, but it kind of changed when I got here. And the thing that I actually studied was like how different environmental stresses affects their growth and aging, or technically like telomere length. So that's what I was looking at. It was like, if they're growing under stressful conditions, is that going to affect the relationship between growth and telomeres? So technically, growth and telomeres are supposed to be negatively related. It's like because of the trade-off. And then usually we don't see them. Like some people saw a negative relationship, some people saw a positive relationship, and there's like no relationship as well. So I was kind of like, maybe these relationship is exacerbated only during stressful conditions. So that's what I was studying. So basically it was just like, what happens to them when they're under stress, and then is that's going to change the relationship that exists between telomeres and growth. Even though we kind of expect them to be negatively related, is that going to change? But it did not. But that will come more into publication, so I won't.
Interesting.
Let, yeah.
You can't
no
give away
spoiler
the
alerts.
Spoilers. I was gonna say, yeah. Academia has its own mm-hmm. rules about spoiler alerts.
Yep.
Well, I'm looking forward to learning more when some of those publications come out. That's a very interesting field, and I do love a house sparrow, pesty as they are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Anuj, what is your favorite bird? Because I understand it is not a house sparrow.
At this point, I would say they are one of my favorites. But I just love owls, and I think it would be really hard to put one name on it, but at least for the US, I would say the Great Gray. Because I've traveled to Sacsahuaxin Bog, which is like 5 hours from here, and I usually go there 5 times a year, even in the winter and in the, like, or in the spring as well as in the winter. So that's like 10 times a year, like 50 plus times in 5 years. But when I first saw it, it was just like this huge bird looking down on you, all weird, like trying to figure out what you are, with his like white bow tie, and then the way just they do their like head thing, look at the food. I just fell in love with Great Grays. So I think
beautiful.
Yeah, I think that has to be my favorite owl for sure. They just look wise to me. I think there's something about Great Grays that like just draws me. They just look like this royal thing that's just like out on a... So the funny thing about that too is like they're huge birds, and you don't think how light they are until you see them on like the small list of the branch thing that's coming out of conifer. And the first time I saw it, it was just one thing, like one tiny thing coming out of the top, and he was on that thing, and nothing, it was like nothing, like he should have been so light, even though he's a big bird. So it's like everything I've seen about them is really appealing, I guess.
I love that. I mean they look like they should weigh 20 pounds.
Yes,
they do. like a small dog.
Yep, they should. But interestingly, they don't.
Well, Anuj, one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on the show was you like to find owls. Mm-hmm. And I live here in Southern California. I'm on a constant quest to find owls. I hike all the time. I have walked by, I'm sure, 50 to 100 owls in the last year that I just didn't see. How do we find owls? Teach me how to find these owls.
So people usually ask me that here as well in Fargo, and like, how do you find them? I'm like, walk a lot. So I think at least with some of the owls that are specific to their habitat, so for example, long-eared or even short-eared, but I would give the example of long-eared and northern saw-whets, is that you need to know their habitats. So for example, right now, if I were to go out looking for long-eared, I'm not going to find it. But 2 weeks from now, if it's a really windy or cold day, and if it's raining or something, if I go scan those conifers, I'm pretty sure that I'm going to find a long-eared in there. So I think it's between the timing and also like the right place to look for them. And one thing with barred owl that I've realized, I don't think that might not be true for other places, and it might just be true for like Fargo, is that they're only found around those like riverine forest or like close to the rivers, like where there was water source. And that has been true for the northern saw-whet owl as well as the long-eared. I think there's something that has to do with like being close to the river. So like in the university that I'm at, the Red River flows through Fargo. It kind of divides Minnesota and North Dakota. And there's a bunch of parks along that like river. And the only places we usually find the saw-whets, long-eards, and even the barred owl is close to the river. there's so many conifers in NDSU, and I've walked through every single conifer at NDSU, never found a single saw-wit or long-eared. But if I were to go to any of those like conifers near the river, I'm going to find one. So I think like figuring out the habitat is one of the key things. And then another thing like is, I don't usually share this a lot with people because they will get very close to the owls. But I think like the people who listen to your podcast are wary like of the fact that they're not going to disturb the owls. So one thing that I do is I look for the pellets. So I look for the trees. I look, try to find the wasps. So if saw it or if a long-eared owl has been using that habitat for a long time, there will be the white wasp, which is basically owl poop. They poop a lot, so it kind of covers the trees. So I look for those and I look for the pellets. And if I find the pellets or if I find the wasp, I know that there's been an owl around. So that's how I kind of like go around looking for those things and then eventually find a saw it in one of those trees.
So you've got to be a little bit of a detective, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yes. And walk a lot. So one of the funny things about Fargo is like, it has been really warm this year, but usually we start getting snow right around this time. But then sawwits aren't back until end of this month. So my guess for this month is 25th of October is when I'm going to see my first sawwit based on eBird data and when I found them before. That's my nail on the thing. So I think the problem is then like starting November and December going into January and February, we have like 2 or 3 feet of snow in the parks. So to find the owl, you have to walk through that. Yeah.
Are and you a this, snowshoer or do you just tap it out?
I don't like snowshoes. The problem again with the snowshoes is like in a places where there's a lot of snow, if it goes down, it's going to be hard to pull those things out. So rather than that, I just walk. And this past year, I was trying to look for sawwits, and then in one of the park, there is, so the river freezes over as well. But in one of the park, what happens is there's a dam. So for a certain section, the river does not flow. So I was like, I'm going to see what's in the river that's unfrozen or like it's flowing. There's like early common golden eyes that kind of make it to Fargo. So I was like, I'm going to go see that. As I started walking, I was like, almost like my hip into the snow and I got stuck in the middle of there. I could not get out of it for like 15 minutes. So I was like panting, trying to get like out of it. And then I'm halfway through it. Like I'm just like equally halfway through it. The car is on the southern side and I need to go to the northern side to get to the river. And I'm like, do I do this or like just turn around? Because that's going to be a lot of effort. But I was like, maybe there's something there. So I took another 1 hour, got to the river, saw nothing, and then came back again on. Yeah. So that's the challenge you face when you're trying to find owls in Fargo.
I mean, you have to really want it, it sounds
yes.
like.
Yes. But when you do get it, that's going to be awesome. Though I've seen probably 500 sawwits in the last 6 years, but I still love seeing them. Like I walk in negative 30s to go see them, and then when you do find them, that's the best feeling. So, and people ask me like, why do you do it? And I'm like, I don't know why I do it. I just do it because my friends think I'm crazy because I always walk in the cold to look for owls that I've seen hundred of times. But yeah,
I get
there's
it.
Something
I get it. Do you have any birding gear that you really like when it's that cold? I mean, I imagine like your hands are freezing, your binoculars are fogging up. Like how do you have any good winter products you recommend to our winter listeners?
So I love winter. And then one of the thing that my advisor, Yuichi Tsuko, about is like how I don't feel the cold, because we taught ornithology together 2 years ago and it was really cold. I think it was like negative 30 and we're birding, all the students were not enjoying it. And I still didn't have my gloves and hat on because I was like walking in the cold. And she was like, how do you do this? So usually I refrain. So the problem also is like to prevent yourself from that cold for your hands and stuff, you need a really big gloves. And when I have that, I don't have the dexterity to use my camera. So I usually don't prefer that. And for the head, I just don't like wearing hats. So I just like accept the cold and move on.
I'm really hoping we don't read your name in the headlines that you were found frozen to a tree somewhere. Take care of yourself,
Anoush. That could happen. That could happen at some point. But usually I'm not well prepared and cold. So I do wear like a snow pant and stuff. Like I'm pretty much well covered in the leg and the upper area, but like hand and head, I don't usually wear anything.
Those Minnesota winters. I grew up in Wisconsin, and those winters are no joke.
No, they're not. They can get nasty.
But those winters bring the saw wet owls, so yes. It's not all bad, right?
No. That's why I'm like, so we did the big seat here in Fargo the other day, and everyone was like, oh, I love how it's fall and it's still like warm weather. I was like, I am ready for snow. And everyone looked at me weird. I'm like, they're like, nope, we don't want it. It's like, I'm ready for the snow.
Yeah, that's one of those things you have to be careful where you say it. Like I worked as a chaplain at a hospital for a while. And if you walk into the emergency room and you say, oh, it's kind of quiet, they will tackle you. You know, they're like, don't say that. Bad things will happen. So
yeah, be careful of what you whisper.
Exactly. Yeah. So Anuj, did you grow up birding in Nepal? Has this been a lifelong passion or is it something newer for you?
I would say mildly newer for me. So when I was young, I've talked about this before too with like other things, but when I was young, I did want to be like an ecologist or like study animals and stuff. Not that I wanted that when I was like five, but I used to watch like Steve Irwin and all of those people on Nat Geo and Discovery, and I was like, oh, I want to be like them. But then at one point when I was like 8th or 9th grade, I was like, oh, you need to study hard for that. And I don't think I want to do that. So I kind of like switched from doing that to doing other stuff. But when I finished my high school, I was like, man, I don't know. Maybe this is what I want to do for my life, because like I love animals and there's so many animals out there. I would love to study animals. And I got into that and I was like, I'm going to study snakes because I wanted to be herpetologist, like all the herpetologist I've seen. And then the first year of undergrad too, I was kind of into that. And then I think it was like during the 3rd year when we had to do the project, I was like, I'm going to look into herpetology or like the herpetofauna of Kathmandu Valley and figure out what they are. But around the same time, I still remember the date because it was the World Wetland Day in 2007, February 2, 2007. There was this small group who wanted to go birding in one of the wetlands in Kathmandu. And I was like, I'm going to join them. So I went with them. And I didn't know like birding was a thing and people actually went to look for birds and stuff. I knew that like people enjoyed that, but I didn't know they did it religiously. So I saw that and I was like, this is fun. So I think that's the turning point for me. And at that point I was like, okay, I could do this. And then I enjoyed like finding birds and I was like, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. So it kind of got into that. So I would say when I was 15 or 16 is when I really started getting into it. And then the eBird thing also is like back home, I didn't know about eBird until I came to the US. And for my master's, I did this figure study in the mountains of Nepal, but I just wrote all of those birds down. And then it was fun too. But then even then, I wasn't like going out just finding birds and doing things. But when I got to the US, and this is where I grew more as a like a birder, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely a U.S. birding culture, I think. The eBird culture and the gearheads and the khaki pants with all the pockets. We got.
Yeah. And I'm glad I kind of got into this too, like the U.S. birding, I guess.
Yeah. So what's next for you now that the PhD is done?
So I did start another job here in NDSU in a different department. And I'm going to be here for a while, but even my eventual plan is to get back to Nepal and do some work there. I want to start a banding station and work on owls there, probably, hopefully. And yeah, so that's the plan. But for the next few years, I'm just thinking about getting all the experience I can while I'm in the US, try to find some collaborators and maybe like get them to work in Nepal, because we haven't been, or the birds in Nepal hasn't been studied a lot in like global scale. So there's a lot of potential there. So I'm just trying to like figure that out. But I think so one of the things that's really bad about me is I don't plan ahead of time, because I leave it until tomorrow and then I'm like, okay, something will come up. But this time around, I'm like thinking about planning like 10 years ahead of now and just like sitting down and writing down like what I want to do. Because I think I need that, because there has to be a plan, at least at this point. So eventually I am going to end up in Nepal, but for now, at least for a few years, I am going to be in Fargo.
Tell us about the birds of Nepal. I know next to nothing except you have a really cool pheasant that I'd like to see at some point.
That's our national bird, the Himalayan Monal, which is really pretty. And then if you do see it, like if you see the male during flight in a sunny day, that's going to be one of your favorite birds, because that's how I saw it first. Because it was like art flying in the sky when I first saw it. It was a beautiful sunny day, and then we were walking in this mountain of Nepal, and then something flashed, and then it just flew across this blue sky with really good light, and it was like someone had like dragged a canvas of painting through helicopter or something in the sky, because it was that pretty. And there's like a lot of beautiful birds in Nepal too. Like even in the mountains, there are like beautiful finches, rosy finches. Those are really good. The grandala, I don't know if you have heard about grandala, but this is a really pretty like blue velvety color bird that's found above 4,000. So that would be like 17,000, 15,000, 70,000 feet, which is a really good bird. And one of the interesting things about Nepal too is like if you go down south, you get lots of like temperate tropical type of birds. And in the hilly region, you kind of start moving up to that like subtemperate. And then in the mountains, you get these Arctic birds. So you can kind of experience all three of those in a single country and get the beautiful birds. From like one of the cool thing that you get to see up in the mountains is like ravens. So when I saw a raven in the in Fargo, I was surprised because we only get ravens high up in the altitude in Nepal. And they were just like in 250 feet or something in Fargo. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. But yeah, we do have a lot of cool birds there. The coolest that I think has to be the snow cocks, which people don't usually like, I guess, because there's a chunky big birds, but they are high up in the mountains and it's really cool to see them. So you're like walking for 7 days to get to this mountain top and you're tired, you're like panting your way up to the mountain, and you see this huge flock of snow cocks just doing their like minding their own business going around. It's good to see them.
I can picture in my mind, like you go to the higher altitudes and suddenly the birds all change, and what a beautiful country with all those varied topographies and climates. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in the city?
I did grow up in the capital city, which is Kathmandu. Yeah. And then I used to see a lot of birds around too. Like when I was, it's really urbanized right now, but when I was young, it wasn't as bad. And we used to get like cattle egrets and lots of like crows and even some like ducks flying over our house during like migration season, which is good to watch, and lots of parakeets. So rose ring parakeets, it's something that I grew up with because they used to be in huge numbers around our house. it was fun. I wish I was really into birding then, so that way I would have longer life list, but I didn't know about it when I was young, so.
I think about that all the time. I grew up in Wisconsin and never noticed a bird. And anytime we go back, I've got my list of like, I know I've seen these before, but they didn't count because I wasn't paying attention. And I need to, you know, I'm on the hunt for crossbills now.
Oh, we saw a flock the other day at the Big Sit, which was awesome. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And I think we do have crossbills back home too. I think we have white wing crossbills back home.
I love the international crossover of birds. You have ravens in Nepal. We have them here, house sparrows. Mm-hmm. But then also we have the red crossbill, and you have the, you know, the differences and the, the uniqueness of the different places. And my bucket list keeps getting longer and longer. And my husband says, is this our whole retirement? And I think, yep, you can do whatever you want, but I'm going out on the hike.
But that's one of the thing too, like, since you asked me what's the future for me or something. So like, I do want to start a birding tour in Nepal, and I bought the domain and I'm working on the website right now. Maybe December of 24 is when I do my first trip, will like get some people and do that, because I'm planning to go home there. But I do want to do one of like birding trip or tour company in Nepal. So that's one of my goals too.
I love that. Let me know. Let me know. I'll put it on the bucket list.
Sounds good. I think you'll, for someone who lives in California, and I think you definitely like hills or mountains, you're definitely going to enjoy that place.
And there's something about a guide, a local guide who grew up there, who knows, you know, the people and the culture and can show you the birds, but also teach you a thing or two about the people of Nepal. I mean, what a gift. What a gift that would be. I wish you well on your quest. And I look forward to seeing where it goes. Yeah. Bird banding in Nepal.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
That would be awesome.
And all of our listeners. Well, Anuj, we talk about birds on this podcast, and we also talk about hope. As someone who works in the sciences, and I'm sure sees some of the ravages of what we've been doing to our planet, where are you finding hope these days?
Like I said, like there's, I think, small community of good. So one of the things that I really like, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan, and one of the things that I always remember is like the Samwise Gamgee's quote about, there's some good in this world and that's worth fighting for. I remember that. And I think there's just like small patches of like hope somewhere, even though the world is in huge turmoil right now. And at least partly for me, I think somehow I found the thing that I love. Like it ended up being like animals, birds, studying this. And this is what I fell in love with. And I think there's hope in things you love, I guess. And like I mentioned before, like every time I feel sad or every time I feel happy, every time there's like in between, I'm like, oh, I need to go look for birds. And somehow like they make me happy. So I think that's where my hope is or my passion is. And I think like people can find their like passion or love in a different way too. Like, but I think it's a hard thing for people to figure out. Because I know, like, people talk to me about this and they're like, oh, you found your thing you love, but we don't know that. I think it's a hard thing, but once you do, I think that's what keeps you going, I guess. Even if everything's falling apart, everything's on fire, I think you somehow find hope in it.
Joy is a great motivator.
Yeah. And like Samwise Gamgee the Wise says, there's some hope and it's worth fighting for. There's some good left in this world and it's worth fighting for. That's what it is.
That is a good word, sir. Yeah. I think the temptation can often be to just marinate in the despair or the news cycle or the, you know, even just the difficulties of the daily grind. But when you can find that spark, I love that we call it a spark bird because it really, you know, that spark of joy. And for other people, it's not birds. It's lacrosse or it's baking or whatever it is. But when it you can find that.
Yeah, it could be anything. And even now, like I wake up in the morning and I check Twitter to see news from Nepal or like from elsewhere. And there's nothing good coming out of it. It's just very sad. And I did tweet about this like 2 days ago. It's like, it's just chaos everywhere. Like it's so hard to see a good news coming out of anywhere. And then the other day I was like, all right, at least like I get good hopes from birds. And I see that news from Chicago with like 1,000 dead birds. And I'm like, I don't know. I think I'm going to quit Twitter.
That was such a rough day. You're talking about a tweet from someone in Chicago where there's, you know, we're recording this in October. It's going to come out in later in the fall, early winter. But there were, you know, all these migratory birds coming through Chicago. And tell us about the tweet. What happened?
Oh, so I was just like, oh, at least the world is burning. But there's some good thing about birds going on. The flamingos are there. The limpkins are there. And I was looking for good stuff. But then I see this tweet where there's like a single building that kind of killed 980 something birds. And I was like, no, this is sad. Like, I don't want this. Like, at least the birds were a good thing in Twitter. And now we're doing that to them. So it was really sad.
Turn off your lights during migration, everybody. The birds hit the windows.
It sucks. Oh. But at least apart from a few of that, like there's still like good thing going around in bird world. So which is good.
And there is something about getting out that, you know, as much as I love Twitter and birding social media and all that, but to get out into the outdoors and see the owl and it's just you and the owl, or see the songbird and it's just you and the songbird. And it's this reminder that the world is on fire, but also there are owls.
Yep, exactly. They're not going to put the fire, but they're going to like dampen your, you know, like depression or something. Like not depression, but just like sadness you have in your life, I guess.
Yeah, they're still out there being owls, you know? They're doing their thing.
Yeah, and then I think there's just something about being outside too. Like, I could be outside. So if I am a field biologist, but there's like some stuff that you have to do back in the lab and the office too. But I wish there was a job where I would just be outside all the time, just working there all day, every day, just being outside. I think if there was a job like that, I would really love to do that. Because I love the outside more than I like the inside, so. Or more to do with animals than humans, I guess.
I love that. And there's hope there. There's so much hope there. So Anuj, have you seen all of the North American owls yet? Or what is left on your owl list?
On the North American, I have... So interestingly, I think my spark bird is the barn owl. And I haven't seen a barn owl in the U.S., but I do have lots of barn owls from back home. So it's technically not going to be a lifer, but I would still want to get that in the U.S. So
they're totally different in the U.S. They have a different accent.
Yep,
totally. They wear their baseball caps backwards. Totally different.
They speak English and the barn owl in Nepal speak Nepali. So like,
exactly.
Definitely new one. So I do want to get those. Northern pygmy owls and then the ferruginous owls. Those are the ones. So kind of like the ones that are found in the Rockies. That's something I need. But most of the ones that are found higher up, like Minnesota, North Dakota, I have all of those. Hmm. Yeah.
500 saw-whet owls. You've seen every saw-whet owl in Minnesota.
Yes. Yeah, I probably have.
I love
but
it.
But one of the best was the boreal owl, which made it to Fargo 2 years ago. And one of the person who's really good at finding saw-whet owls found that guy. And it was really cool to see that because I've been to the bog looking for them. And they're like this tiny baseball looking thing. You're never going to find it in a place you don't know. And great gray northern hawk owl, which is one of my favorite. And I got one of those while I was skiing in northern North Dakota, north central North Dakota. I was on a ski lift and I see this thing on top of the tree. And I was like, that looks like an owl. And then as I went up higher, it was like a northern hawk owl just doing its thing. It was awesome.
The chairlift. That's amazing.
Yep. Yeah. But yes, I have most of the owls from here. Like the molted owls and the I do have the barred owl. What was the other one? But most of the ones that are found down south is what I need. But usually from the north up, anything that's found in North Dakota, I have all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you seeing in terms of the younger generations coming up in scientific education? Are you seeing folks that are more interested in ecology? What are you seeing in terms of the students that you encounter and work with?
I think it depends year and year. So like 2 years ago when we did the ornithology, I don't know if any one of those students are going to listen to this, but like they were not as much interested in it. But this time when I taught the ornithology in the spring, everyone was really into birds, which was awesome to see. And I managed to convert some of them into really good e-birders or like hardcore e-birders, at least five or six of them, which was awesome because I stuck everyone in e-bird. So like 3 times a day, I'm on eBird trying to see what has like been seen. People have found whatever and stuff. And I see my students turn up in there. And I was like, yes, I have like 5 different people who eBird. And I was like, oh, this is good to see. But I think it depends upon people too. Like, but in overall, I think there's equal or like equilibrium amount of people that are interested in this. I don't think it's going down. But I don't know if it's going up either, but there's a good amount of people that are interested in nature and like science. So
I love that you're having your students on eBird. That's brilliant.
Yeah. So I think I had like 16 students. I don't think everyone does it, but I have 5 or 7 students who eBird every day.
Yeah, every little bit helps.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that feels good too. Like they were really interested and the class was really fun and yeah, it was awesome.
Do you ever have to log in and dispute their findings? Like, that is not a pileated woodpecker. Like, you're wrong. I taught you poorly.
No, I don't have to. But one of the funny thing that one of my students brings up is, like, in February, we are not supposed to have anything. And one of my friend calls me. So the community is pretty small, and then usually they see around and stuff. So, like, they know that I work with birds and stuff. And one of my friend called me, and I was like, oh, one of my friend found this bird. He's outside his window. Can you come collect it? And I was like, okay. And I thought it was going to be, like, a junco or chickadee or something because it was February. So I went to the person's house, and there's a belted kingfisher there in the middle of, like, first week of February with, like, 50 inches of snow in Fargo. And I was like, this is weird. And I got that guy, and he was kind of stunned, probably like tried to migrate early. He was just tired. So I brought him in, and then I had to go teach a class. So I just, it was an ornithology class. So I just took him in, and I wanted to show the bird to the kids. So like I took it in, and I was like, all right, I have this kingfisher with me. And I don't remember if this is true or like if this really happened, but my student Abby claims that this happened. For some reason, I called the belted kingfisher a woodpecker, which would be a weird mistake to make, but she was like, she still tells me about it. But I think I might have said that. For some reason, I said, like, this is a woodpecker or something, and she always makes fun of me for saying that. But that was a mistake that I made, and she told me that she corrected it. But I don't know if the detail is right, though. The
story's going to live forever, though.
I know. That's the thing.
The students are going to be checking your eBird to make sure you're not leading them astray.
It should have been the other way around, but yeah. So every time I say something about kingfisher, she's like, woodpecker? Is that what you mean? I'm going, no, I don't think I made that mistake. And then with a person that worked with us during the summer, and we kind of, Abby worked with us too, and we kind of made her into e-birder, and now we see e-birds as well. And then she never had Cooper's hawk on her e-bird list, so I was like, oh, I know this nest, and I think we can find the Cooper's hawk around, so let's go look for it so we can add it to your e-bird. And then we walk around university to get to the nest, and there's like this squirrel, like whatever, ermine kind of animal in the ground. And I was like, is that a squirrel in the ground? Because it's doing like that and looking up. And I was like, that looks like a squirrel. It ended up being the Cooper's hawk.
It's on the ground.
Yep. He was on the ground and extending his neck and looking at things. And from like a distance, I thought he was a squirrel. And I said, oh, there's a squirrel on the ground. As we walked closer, it was a Cooper's hawk. And she was like, what's wrong with you?
who's the professor? Who's in charge?
Yeah, so I've made mistakes like that before, so I don't think they would agree on me correcting their mistakes. I would let the e-bird reviewers do that.
See, you don't necessarily have to own up to it as a mistake, though. You can say it's a negative example because you're trying to teach them, right?
That is true. I could just be like, oh, look at this woodpecker. And people would be like, is that a woodpecker? And I was like, good. That's what I wanted.
Testing you. Exactly.
You best.
I'm teaching, our middle kid is 7 years old, and I'm teaching him how to play chess. And often I'm realizing the best way to teach him is by making terrible mistakes so that he can notice, you know, like, oh, her queen's right out there in the open. I'm going to take that queen. So that's all you're doing. Yep, it was all on purpose.
It's just subtle. But yeah, that's what I'm doing.
I've never seen a Cooper's hawk on the ground unless it's eating something. It was just chilling, huh?
Yeah, it was just chilling and it was looking for something. But so it kind of flushed after we got there, and I tried to look to see if there was something on the ground that it was eating. But there was nothing. I don't know what he was doing, but he was just on the ground. And then he did look like some kind of mammal that was on the ground looking up. So
I mean, they are. They have that head coloring that looks very like gray squirrel, winter marmot. Yeah, I feel you. I think you're in the clear.
Yeah.
You're absolved.
But usually I do have good reputation of finding birds and stuff. So I think it didn't dent or like put a dent on my reputation, I guess. So it was good enough.
Good enough. Good enough is good enough for sure.
Yep.
Well, Anuj, how can people connect with you and your work? Where can folks find you?
So I am on Twitter. And again, going back to my original passion of animals, I really love snakes. So my Twitter handle is it's just like Mr. and Ophiophagus, which is Ophiophagus hanna is the scientific name of king cobra. I really loved king cobra. So I kind of went with that back in 2008 or something, and I've been using that for a while now. So it's Mr. Ophiophagus on Twitter. And then I think if you just Google my name and NDSU, if it's for like professional stuff, want to connect with research and all, if you just Google my name and NDSU, you should see my email and everything on it. So
perfect. I'll link to that in the show notes as well. And just for all of our listeners, Anuj is a delightful follow on Twitter. He's lots of fun, really informative stuff, some great photos, and the occasional misidentification of a marmot that's actually a Cooper's hawk.
And the woodpecker.
Anuj, thank you so much for the gift of your time. I really appreciate it. I've learned so much from you, and I'm going to go look for owls.
Thank you for having me here. And it was really fun talking to you too.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What does it go in your soul?
Yes, it does.